This is the Commodity Culture Podcast, where we interview prominent investors, fund managers, analysts, and company CEOs to give you an edge when it comes to investing in the commodity space. Hello, everybody, and welcome to Commodity Culture, where our goal is to make you a better investor in the commodity space. My name is Jesse Day. Before we dive in, standard disclaimer, nothing here is investment advice. Do your own due diligence. And today's guest is a speculator with a track record of winning recommendations, a writer, and the founder of the Independent Speculator, somebody I always love talking to. It's Lobo Tigre. Welcome back to the show.
Thanks. And sorry to jump sideways here, but that disclaimer, everybody says that. I don't think it'll help much if the powers that be decide to come after us. But I like the part about do your own due diligence, because that's like my other motto. I'm the due diligence guy on Twitter. And I think that's a great thing to remind people and encourage them.
Yes, I do think there's a lot of people who just watch programs like this and listen to stock recommendations or, you know, hear about certain sectors and then suddenly decide to allocate capital in them. And that is not smart. So it takes a lot of time and effort to invest successfully, especially when we're talking about picking individual securities. And that's what you help people out with. And I do want to touch on something you mentioned in a recent edition of the free version of your newsletter, where you said that there is a glaring contradiction in the fact that the Fed raised projections for inflation and economic growth, yet still expects 3 rate cuts this year as the broad market continues to rip to all-time highs. You added that it makes sense, though, if viewed through a political lens. Could you break that down for us?
Sure. Well, first and foremost, to be fair, the dots did move. They moved more next year and the year after, and they moved somewhat this year, the dots on the so-called dot plot, the summary of economic projections. But they just didn't move enough to change the projection from 3 to 2 cuts, but they did move. So it's not like there was no motion there at all. But there is still this contradiction. You know, how can you say, you know, that things are looking better or hotter, if you will, in the economy, but therefore easier policy is justified? I mean, these things just don't make sense. And it's not just the Fed. It's Congress, too. I mean, we're close to $1 trillion already this year, the end of the first quarter, in deficits. You know, not to take sides on Democrat versus Republican, because, you know, Trump ran deficits, too. But, you know, how can you say that Bidenomics has saved the economy and it's the greatest economy ever? How can it be necessary to run such monstrous deficits if everything is fine? Deficit spending is a tool, just like the Fed's so-called tools. It's a tool for a weak economy. How can either of these policies be justified if everything's doing so great? There's a glaring contradiction there. But yes, if you look at it through a political lens, there's no contradiction at all. Of course, Congress critters are going to vote for more pork. That's how they, you know, buy off, you know, the dear consumer slash voter. Sorry, but it's pure bribery. There's no, I think, no honest person can look at the political process in the United States and not conclude that it is, as H.L. Mencken said, you know, an advance auction on stolen goods. It just seems incontrovertible to me. It's a little bit more controvertible, if you will, the Fed's role, because they're supposedly independent. They'll swear till they're blue in the face that they're independent. And yet, it's not just anarchist, crazy libertarian rabble-rousers like me, but even mainstream media folks will say, yeah, but it's an election year. Well, what does that mean? It's an election year, so they are political? I mean, yeah, exactly how would that gets put into motion or not? Okay, even taking the most Fed charitable view, the Fed could refrain from doing what it thinks is the right thing if it thinks that that would be interpreted as political and therefore threaten its independence and so on. But even that is, it's by reverse psychology, that's still political. That's still not doing what you think is the right thing. So I don't know how far you want to go down that rabbit hole, Jesse. We can pull out all kinds of cool conspiracy theories. I think it's enough just to say that, A, the contradiction is there, and B, therefore it is reasonable to expect a change in course. Like, these two things are at odds. Something has to give. either the economy is not as great as they're telling us, which is my view, or the economy is doing better and the powers that be are, you know, like massaging the narrative here, getting ready for rate hikes or some other change of course. Oh, sorry. I don't want to go too far down this rabbit hole, like I say, but rate hikes, when inflation is still high, like normally people think, oh, rate hikes, that's bad for gold because gold doesn't pay interest, right? In this context where the Fed has not yet brought inflation back to its goal, pivoting to higher rates, that's an admission of defeat. You know, that's admitting that you've been Arthur Burns and not Paul Volcker. So interesting times, Jesse.
Yeah, it seems their supposed tools are not getting the job done. And you believe that the economy is in for a hard landing. You expect an easy money response from the Fed, which you think will send gold much higher. We were speaking off camera before hitting record today, and you mentioned that your highest conviction trade for 2024 was gold. Walk us through why you think gold is currently at nominal all-time highs and any other catalysts you see that you think could ignite the price higher.
The thesis is basically the same as it was last year. And you could say, oh, well, Lobo, you were wrong. There was no recession by the end of last year. I might push back a little and say, well, you know, there was certainly an earnings recession. There was a commodities recession. There was a freight recession. There was a manufacturing recession. You know, the so-called rolling recession was, you know, undeniable enough that even mainstream folks on Yahoo Finance or Bloomberg or whatever were discussing it. What we didn't have was the two quarters of negative GDP, though we did have that in 22. But I don't want to quibble on this. You know, it looks like the economy was stronger than, you know, undeniable recession in the United States would have had you. So Lobo, you were wrong. Yeah, okay, I was wrong. I was wrong by saying end of 2023. I didn't fully work into my thinking the magnitude of the stimmy checks and the low interest rates and how companies and households had insulated themselves from rate hikes with super low interest rates. And so the Fed hiked, but it had much less impact than it would otherwise have had. And therefore, the long and variable lags would be longer and perhaps more variable this time because of this extraordinary circumstance. So a key point here, and I've said this before, but I think it's an important takeaway, is all these people running around on mainstream financial media and their political masters, I believe, saying, oh, if there's no recession by now, there's not going to be one. That's simply an ignorant thing to say in light of history. We are just now getting to where we'd be at the average length of those long and variable lags. It's even just never mind the COVID lockdowns and the stimmy checks and all the crazy things done. Just historically, it's, you know, the long and variable lags aren't even late yet. We're just now getting to the average length. If they go months more, that would be a little bit more than average, not, you know, long overdue. So I just think that's ignorant is the charitable word. I think it's spin. I think it's people trying to convince you that something is better than it is. It's lipstick on a pig. Don't buy it. So that alone is a catalyst in my view. I think that recessionary call, that's why I'm still on team hard landing. I think that's still coming. I think the cracks that we see in the labor market, I mean, and not just the recent headlines, but the trend and the JOLTS numbers and so on have been down for months. The unemployment rate is ticking up. This is a Jeff Gundlach thing. When the unemployment rate starts doing what look like golden crosses, but when you consider the implications that it's unemployment, not employment, it's actually a death cross. When you get the numbers starting to cross the long-term averages, that is a very tried and true recession indicator. And employment is lagging. Again, lagging indicator. So yes, that has a very high correlation with higher gold prices. Sorry, gold dollar exchange ratio. It's gold is money. It's not pork bellies or coffee beans. So that alone is a catalyst. On top of that, we have, even without that, the Fed saying they're going to cut, or that it's likely that it'll be appropriate for them to cut, right? And rate cuts are bullish for gold. So just those sort of basic macro settings are there. And then, of course, if we look beyond the U.S. and the economic lens, we have two hot wars, either of which could turn into World War III at a moment's notice. I mean, it seems like, oh, well, you know, again, if it hasn't happened by now, it's not going to happen. And I sincerely hope they don't. I'm not looking for World War III. I don't want that to happen. But there is real risk in the world of seriously bad things happening. And that is the sort of thing that reminds people that, you know, a little bit of hedge with a safe haven isn't a bad thing. And then we've got the central bank gold buying, you know, record levels of central bank gold buying. And what's really striking to me, and to focus this on today's conversation, Jesse, is, okay, it's been going on for a while. It has supported gold at a time of higher rates and so on that, you know, normally would have been bad for gold. I think that's really important because now we're going into what would normally be good for gold, cutting rates, recessionary signals. But we're not going into it at a cyclical gold low. It's not like last time we were down under 1,400, 1,300. Right. Or the time below, we're down below, well, I guess leading to 2019, we're at 256 or something. Like, we're not going into what looks like an obviously bullish setup for gold from a low. We're going into it at record, at least nominally, all time highs. So the potential here is extraordinary. You know, a modest 10 or 20% move in gold, which would be nothing compared to prior bull markets, which, you know, are orders of magnitude greater. You know, that would take us to such screaming headline gold dollar exchange ratio numbers, right? A real all-time high adjusted, just using the government's crazy CPI numbers, which I see as a very conservative case. Using CPI, a real all-time high in gold would be over $3,400 now. I mean, just imagine the headlines. Just imagine the attention. You know, even crypto crypto kings and Bitcoin hodlers could say, hey, look at that. There's something else that's got momentum. I think there are diehards in that space that will never buy gold. But I think the majority, they're momentum chasers. They'll buy anything that's hot. So there's flavor of the day potential here, could be another catalyst, if you will. It doesn't have to happen. You know, if none of the, you know, I certainly don't want World War III to happen. I just don't even want those conflicts to even escalate, let alone blow up in a big way. These extra things don't have to happen. We've got, even my hard landing doesn't have to happen. The mainstream view is that the Fed is going to cut. That's bullish for gold. You know, that is a very easy case to make. There's nothing extraordinary in claiming here. And then we've also got the central bank gold buying, which I think is an unusually stout case. Now, it's not something we can rely on in the sense that they don't necessarily do it every month. I don't think there's a coordinated plan where somebody's telling them, okay, Turkey, you buy this much this month, you know, South Africa, you buy this much this month, India, you know, that's not how it works. And so central bank, you know, as a gold bug, it's hard for me to want to see the central banks as the good guys, right? For the central banks to be my savior, there's something pretty messed up in the world when that's happening. But it is happening. And the reason for it, you know, as we all know, is the weaponization of the dollar. We all know. I mean, they don't say it explicitly, but it's understood, and I think a very defensible position, that the United States going nuclear on Russia with the dollar and the SWIFT system and seizing reserves, you know, that can't be taken back. You know, even if Putin kisses and makes up with Zelensky and, sorry, we'll go back to half Crimea back. All these likely things, right? You know, even if that happened, and China's not going to say, oh, okay, we trust the U.S. to manage our financial lifeblood. It's not going to happen. So I see that as a one-way change that is a game changer for gold and silver, by the way, as a monetary metal. And so between that and rate cuts, I'm extremely bullish on gold for this year.
And your highest conviction trade of 2023 was the other yellow metal, uranium. And that seemed to be spot on, as it was the best performing commodity of the year. You wrote in your newsletter recently, in the specific context of 2024, I love that a two yellow metals portfolio is self-hedging in case my outlook is wrong, and it's a win-win if I'm right. So what would have to happen for your hard landing thesis to go wrong, to not play out the way you think it would? And why does a gold and uranium portfolio hold its own in either scenario?
I mean, the mainstream will tell you that my hardlining thesis is already wrong. Look how wonderful everything is. Look at GDP, 3.4 instead of 3.2. And look at inflation is only 3%, you know, way down from 9%. Never mind that any inflation at all makes your cost of living higher. And that the Fed's target is 50% below that. Never mind the man behind the curtain. You know, 3% is wonderful. Let's move the goalposts. So there's a happy, happy, joy, joy narrative out there now. Team No Landing is saying Lobo is wrong. So you could just go with Team No Landing with their ever so sound and indisputable logic. Or you could say, all right, yeah, let's just say that it's not a hard landing. It's a soft landing and things aren't so bad. And the Fed and the Congress kisses the boo-boo and there's no big scare. So that would be contra Lobo and maybe bearish for gold. But you know, in that case, they're still going to cut rates. So I just don't see, you know, famous last words, but I just don't see anything that really knocks gold back down to cyclical lows. I think the worst likely case scenario here is that we muddle sideways or maybe drift lower for a while until the next big blow up happens. But the important point in the question here is, you know, what could make me wrong is what I don't know, what I don't see. Therefore, I don't see it, I don't know it, and I can't tell you, right? I could imagine all kinds of things. But let's just stipulate, let's just say I am wrong. The point is, let's say gold really craters, you know, goes back down, you know, $500 or something like that from here. To price levels that would inflict serious harm on the mining industry, by the way, which has had cost inflation, right? So, you know, that would be very serious for me because, you know, I buy gold as savings. My speculation is in gold stocks. A gold meltdown, you know, I don't care about my savings. That's a long-term holding. It doesn't matter what the current ratio is. But it's a wipeout for my stocks. On the other hand, in that happy scenario where Bidenomics really has saved the day and everything's fine. It's very bullish for energy demand and that includes uranium. So that's bullish there. And then we have the supply and deficit. The supply deficit now, you know, intrinsic to that space, which by the way, I think makes it recession resistant. So that's what I mean by win-win. If we get the hard landing, I don't think that's actually going to affect uranium much at all. And especially with Kazatomprom yanking guidance and even failing to produce as much in the last year as the year before. I mean, there is serious concern about supply at a time when demand is soaring in the nuclear energy space. So it's possible that we could have this hard landing. Gold goes up and uranium goes up, even while oil goes down, other energy minerals go down, copper, you know, all industrial and energy minerals go down except for uranium because of the specific supply crunch in that space. So I had said, I'm losing the thread of your question a little bit here, but to sum up, I had said that uranium was my highest conviction trade last year. This year it's gold. But the news from Kazakhstan and that major supply shift has changed my view. So this year it's both yellow metals. I have equally high conviction for both of them. Though I suspect with uranium prices now above the incentive price to mine the stuff, you know, maybe there's flavor of the day potential there. If the meme stock guys realize that uranium is a tiny enough market that they could try to put a squeeze on it, right? It would be funny to see some of our uranium miners become the next meme stock. That could actually happen because the mainstream is now coming around to nuclear energy. I just saw a headline this morning about the Biden administration approving like a $1.9 billion loan to put a mothballed nuclear power plant back into operation first. And that's not just a first. It's a first. It's in the United States where there's a lot of hysteria about the subject of nuclear power and misinformation. And it's the Biden administration, which, okay, they've actually been more pro-nuclear for some time now, but this is putting their money where their mouth is. And it's the Biden administration that is the most sympathetic, not sympathetic, the most on board with the climate change scare and all that. So in previous times, they would have been anti-nuclear. So for standard bearers for the climate change movement in government to include nuclear now, this is a game changer. This is huge. And we're seeing the actual money hitting the market now. The United States government is buying uranium for a national uranium reserve. That's a new source of demand that just didn't exist, you know, a year ago. And, you know, in both sides, it's bipartisan, actually, to be pro-nuclear now. And then it's not just the United States. We've got, after COP28, a couple dozen countries are saying they're going to triple their nuclear power output. It's got the green taxonomy in Europe. I could go on and on. Like, this is a different uranium market than it was just a couple years ago. You know, prices had gone up. So my main reason for shifting highest confidence from uranium to gold this year was that uranium had had a fantastic run and a correction was due. And gold, it was still in the breakout phase, but the gold stocks hadn't really paid much attention to the rising price of gold. So I saw greater opportunities in the gold stocks. And now uranium has corrected. Gold is breaking out. I see fantastic opportunities in both.
Great. Well, you've answered my next question about Kazatomprom potentially changing your view on the uranium sector. So I'd like to ask you about the recent developments in Niger, obviously an area for uranium mining that has seen a tumultuous couple of years here, both with the coup and then everything seemed to be stabilizing. And now we're seeing geopolitical issues arise once again with the Niger cutting off ties with the US military. We're seeing the equities that have mines under development or who are exploring for uranium in Niger drop quite a bit in response to this news. Is Niger a jurisdiction you would avoid completely at this point? Is this a buying opportunity? How do you view that situation?
Yeah, when the coup came out, I put a no-go zone on there. I sold and communicated that clearly to clients. I have in interviews and so on, I've said, look, when you get political risk like this, you just don't know how bad it can get or how long it can be. It can get to the point where they start shooting, you know, the white people building the mines. It can be that nothing happens. It blows over. There have been coups in West Africa where the new junta, you know, they just want things to continue. They want the revenue from the taxes to continue and the jobs to continue. So I'm not saying that a coup is always the kiss of death and it means necessarily 100% that your investment is done. I'm saying that you don't know. There is no way to know. There is absolutely no way, not Rick Brule, not Doug Casey, you know, not Ross Beaty or Eric Sprott, not little old me. Nobody can tell you what is going to happen as a coup plays out and so on. The track record, though, is that it's pretty bad and that it often takes a very long time for things to come around again. It takes a new government usually years to demonstrate its bona fides, that this is a safe place to invest. And investments in those countries are often just dead money for a long time. They just don't recover to previous highs. Now, there's a spectacular counterexample in Niger just now. One junior in particular in that, I'm not going to name names, but the stock fell off a cliff on the coup and then it more than recovered. It had been trading until this latest news at share prices above where they were where the coup happened. I mean, this in my mind was absolutely a case of irrational exuberance. The coup is not long enough in the past that we can say, oh yes, everything's fine. Okay, the coup had nothing to do with uranium, I get it, but it's still a coup. You don't know how far the bullets are going to fly in a situation like that. Now we have this new thing, and the stocks, not just that one, but others fell off a cliff again. To me, that seems utterly unsurprising. The people who chase those stocks back up again after, oh, the coup's done and nothing bad has happened to uranium, I think that was not a wise decision. And what's happened now is par for the course. That's why it wasn't wise, because stuff like this can happen. You never know. Now, does this mean Niger is done? No, not necessarily. Even this new thing has really nothing to do with uranium or mining in general, any mining in Niger. There's an argument to be made that it's business as usual. But It's not necessarily an incorrect argument, but it's an argument that ignores the elephant in the room of other risks, non-mining related, that can blow up your investment in that space. So my answer is no, I would absolutely not put any money in Niger or any country in a similar circumstance. Probably not. It would take years for me to feel comfortable going back into a space like that. And if I miss out on opportunities, that's fine. I'm okay with missing out on opportunities. I don't know. Sometimes, Jesse, I think I'm a mutant. I just don't feel FOMO. Or another way of putting it is Doug Casey's saying of you can't kiss all the girls. It's okay. You don't have to kiss all the girls. And if you try, you're just going to get black eyes. So I'm okay with missing out on extremely high risk speculations in areas where, you know, your CEO and his geological team could literally just get shot. You know, it's very hard for a company to recover from things like that.
That was a great breakdown. I wanted to touch on silver here. This
I'm
is
gonna
a
get
metal.
Rotten Tomatoes for that. Sorry, because there's people that love those stuff. But you know what? I'm not a cheerleader. I'm trying to be helpful. That is my sincere take. It's what I did, not just, you know, theoretically. I owned one of those stocks. I sold it. Absolutely no regret.
Yeah, but we need more voices like that, because uranium on social media, I'm thinking of X, Twitter in particular, is kind of a groupthink sort of situation where people literally think that tweeting positive things about certain companies or uranium is somehow going to push the stock up. So I think it's great to get a more balanced, realistic take on the situation. I do want to touch on silver here. It's a metal people love to hate these days. There's kind of a weird love-hate relationship with silver, where people seem to love to watch interviews I post about silver, for example, but yet the comment section is then filled with people who watched the video, who literally clicked on a video about silver to then tell me how stupid I am to be talking about silver. It's never going to go anywhere. It's a useless metal. So it's, I don't know what's behind that sort of psychology there. What are your current thoughts on silver? You know, our friend Rick Rule says he loves that it's so unloved right now. He thinks that presents a big opportunity. What are your thoughts?
So no disrespect to women, but I think that saying that hell hath no fury like a woman scorned is incorrect. I think the greater fury is the speculator contradicted. You know, you just tell some guy on Twitter or gal on Twitter that, you know, their favorite company might have a few issues, and boy, yeah, does the hate just come pouring out. But to be fair, you know, it's Twitter. This isn't peer-reviewed papers, and people are usually posting anonymously. There's a handle there that's not their real name or something. It's and just real quick, not to go down the social media rabbit hole too far, but there is something important here. Like what you said is important. Like when people are touting XYZ stock, I think it's reasonable to conclude that they own it and they're promoting it, right? They're not doing it for free. The saying on the internet, I think, is very wise. That if something is free, you are the product. And I think all investors should remember that as far as anything that they get for free. This is why I don't name stock picks. Or one big reason is I don't want to come across as a tout. If I own it, I don't want to be accused of promoting it. If I don't own it, I don't want to be accused of being paid to promote it or something like that, right? It's just better not to go there and talk about the ideas and the more important underpinnings of why we make the decisions. And then you're an independent speculator. Make your own choice. But anyway, just remember, you know, some faceless, nameless person on Twitter is not a reliable source of investment advice. You know, I shouldn't have to say this. But the consequences for them, if they say, oh, yeah, this is great. Oh, yeah, Lobo's terrible because he didn't like this or whatever. You know, what are the consequences for them if they're wrong? Nothing. They're nobody on Twitter. Whereas if you know, I wince to even think of myself this way, but if as an influencer in the mining space, I say, oh yeah, this is great, pile in, and I'm wrong, I've hurt a lot of people. So, you know, I need to be careful. Even if I only cared about myself and my reputation, then I would be careful. But I actually don't want to hurt people. I want to help people to do well. So, dear audience, if you get impatient with me for being the voice of reason instead of cheering whatever you're most excited about, that's why. I am sincerely trying to look out for you as best I can. Take it or leave it. All right. So I forgot the question, Jesse. Oh, silver. Right. Oh, yeah. Silver. Yeah. Yeah. Well, let me pull out my Darth Silver mask. The Wall Street Silver guys have dubbed me Darth Silver.
You actually have a mask. That's awesome.
Because I've dared to say that silver might not live up to the hopes this time around. And you know what? This ties into the way you frame the question, though. The silver bulls got so, maybe not even irrationally, I won't say they were wrong fundamentally, but they got so exuberant, right, that people did pile in and their silver stocks have gone down. Or, you know, gold did spectacularly well after the COVID crisis and the gold led inflation before it happened. Gold told you inflation was coming, which is interesting. Gold's up now. Is gold telling us something? Right? So, but silver didn't. Both of them got whacked in 2020. Gold came screaming back up and silver was doing the I'm falling and I can't get up routine. Right? So people who bought into the exuberance at that time got hurt. And I understand why they would be mad now and why they would hate silver now. I remember there's a YouTube thing. I think some Bitcoin guys made it of like caveman days where there's this guy trying to come up and buy, you know, a brontosaurus steak or something a la Flintstones with gold. And the guy in the store is like, gold, can I eat it? No. Well, what good is it? You know, and they have this long argument and the gold guy finally goes away. And then another guy comes up and says, oh, this is gold 2.0. It's silver. And the caveman just pulls out a big bone and whacks him on the head. Like, that's how hated silver is. I completely disagree with the thesis of the video, but obviously it was effective. I remember it. But the point, though, is like with silver, is like the Rodney Dangerfield of the metals here. Can't get no respect these days. And there's, you know, I do think that silver bulls should, you know, own up to that a bit. If people on Twitter or whatever, X, you know, got all excited and, you know, silver squeeze and yeah, we're going to send it to the moon. And if you tell everybody this will happen, you don't just say, oh, there's an opportunity here. We're going to try or we like this. But you say, oh, yeah, silver's going to the moon. Yeah, our team. Well, you're creating the context for disappointment. And those disgruntled people now are going to be all the harder to bring around again. So I do think it pays to, you know, have a little, try to be level-headed if you can about your speculative investment theses. Anyway, but to answer the question, silver. Increasingly, over the last 2 years, silver has been visibly trading on a short-term basis more like copper than gold. And this is what gets me the Darth Silver eggs and all that stuff, right? You know, this is a fact. Like you just watch it on an intraday basis. And we've been seeing, you know, days where gold goes like this and copper and silver going, yeah, right? Now, overall, the correlation between gold and silver is still high. But this is a new thing in this space. And I think it's a fact, a trend that's worth watching. Now the good news is that even if the gold-silver ratio keeps widening, generally speaking, they do go in the same direction. It hasn't completely broken down. So even in a worst-case scenario, if gold does break out to, you know, a real all-time high, there's no way I think silver gets left behind completely. Silver may or may not reach a nominal all-time high. But you know what? Just going from 25, mid-20s to 30s, let alone 40s, you know, that would be very exciting. The percentage gain for silver at that point would be huge. And the impact on silver miners, the marginal impact in their profit margins, I mean, not marginal as unimportant, I mean, margin as in profit margin, the impact for their margins will be huge. So, and that should, in a world that hasn't gone completely insane, that should translate to silver stock prices. So I like silver. I still see it as a monetary metal, despite my Darth mantle. And I was very encouraged. I mean, I'm not saying there's anything good about war. This isn't Schadenfreude, but a silver lining, no pun intended, of the recent wars is that we did see silver move like a monetary metal should, particularly last October, not like copper, not like oil. It moved like gold in response to purely geopolitical threats that have, if anything, negative implications for silver's industrial demand, but very positive implications for safe haven assets in that context. So I find this very encouraging because I've been more and more concerned about silver acting like copper in recent years. And so to see silver really act like gold in a moment of crisis was very encouraging. And so I am a silver bull, but even, the most ardent silver bulls will tell you that silver typically underperforms at first in a new bull market and then catches up with gold in the end. So that being the case, even though I'm a bull, I'm not in a huge hurry to deploy into silver right away. I think we have time, given the historic pattern of silver underperforming at first, we have time to see if this breakout in gold really has legs, if it's not going to fizzle on us. And then we can, then we can bet on silver catching up later. There's a lot more I could say, but that's the short version.
You have mentioned as well that you are staying away from copper, oil, and other purely industrial commodities for the time being until you see how the economy plays out. In that case, and in the case of this hard landing scenario, which you see coming, and I think a lot of people who are paying attention to the fundamentals think the same way, are there any other asset categories outside of gold, uranium, and potentially silver that you think could provide investors with some shelter from the storm?
Well, any, sure, but not in my wheelhouse. I never told people to short NVIDIA. I didn't buy NVIDIA, and I didn't tell people to buy NVIDIA. That's not my thing. I don't know. Cocoa now is going vertical. I miss the cocoa spike. Hate me if you want to, but, I'm not a farmer. What do I know about cocoa? It's a commodity. Okay, it's a commodity. But, I'm a natural resource, mining, minerals, extractive industries guy. So, yeah, I missed the cocoa spike. But you know what? Even as a person ignorant of the cocoa market, and yes, I understand that there's environmental conditions in Africa, one of the big sources of cocoa. There's reasons for this. And you know what? Farming goes on yearly cycles in general. Well, tropical farming can go year round. So I'm not sure. I don't know. I am ignorant of the fundamentals of the cocoa market to say how long a supply crunch there could last. But it doesn't seem like the sort of thing that spins on a dime and gives you 5 cent change. So maybe cocoa is something that can keep going. But just look at that. My experience as an investor and a speculator over the last couple of decades is that no price goes vertical forever. And the last time I said this and I got all these rotten tomatoes from uranium bulls was, me being rude enough to say that on the uranium panel at Vancouver, and I did the same thing. I did this. I said, look at it, a breather at the very least, if not an actual correction, would be the logical expectation here. So in my complete ignorance of the cocoa market, I'm just looking at that chart. Call me a TA if you want on this one. Could it go up? Yeah. Can it go stay vertical? No, no price can go to infinity. So I'm getting a little bit distracted, but sure, there's opportunities out there in other spaces. But in my wheelhouse, it's not just that I'm focused on gold and uranium, the two yellow metals this year. I am literally unwilling to buy anything else at this point. I'm very bullish on copper for decades to come. I actually think, as much as people love to hate electric cars, I think coming out of the recession, lithium is going to come back, might even help nickel a bit. There's other things to look at on the other side of the recession. Oil is a no-brainer. I'm very bullish on oil after the recession because energy gets whacked going into the recession if you don't have this protection that the uranium space has. So yeah, it's a simple answer, Jesse. Basically, no, not of the things that I track. Again, I want to stress, I'm not pretending or telling anybody that you should buy only gold and uranium stocks and nothing else. I'm saying that part of your portfolio that you're allocating to metals and mining and minerals, that's what I'm doing with my money in this space.
That's why I love talking to you, because you are so honest and level-headed, and you've got the conviction, you're putting your money where your mouth is, and you're not recommending anything that you yourself are not researching and investing in. So that's great. Now, our goal on this show is to make people who are watching better investors in the commodity space. With that goal in mind, are there any final words you could leave the viewers and the listeners with, any final thoughts that could perhaps help speculators out there?
I was just asked this last night by Adrian Day, and I think boiling it down to the simpler answer, I think skepticism is an absolute cardinal essential virtue to successful speculation and investment in general, maybe even life in general. I hate to come across as a Debbie Downer or as a negative guy. I don't think I'm a very negative person in general, but you have to be skeptical. You know, whether it's politicians promising this, that, or the other, or the contradiction that we see in the Fed, it pays to be skeptical. Very, very few people in any public walk of life are thoroughly honest. They all have an agenda, and it behooves us to say, what is the interest of this person? You know, back to our space, when you go to PDAC or even Jay Martin's show, you know, there's no way to vet the exhibitors for sainthood. Like, that's not on the form. And if you put it in the form, all the demons would check off the saint box. Of course they would. They're demons. What do you expect, right? So when you walk around the floor and you ask these guys questions, assume they're bullshitting you. And I mean that in the technical sense of the term. See Neil Stephenson. And that's their job. And it's your job to be skeptical, to parse that, try to figure out what of it is true or what of it is not only true, but material and relevant, right? It's the same thing like we started talking about with social media. You know, just be skeptical. That doesn't mean don't believe anything, take all your marbles and go home. But back to your disclaimer, it does mean that due diligence, doing your own due diligence, even me, you can't take everything I say for granted. I hope you'll listen to it and then do your own due diligence and decide for yourself what you think. But you should. You can't trust anybody blindly in this space, or you will sooner or later get your posterior handed to you.
Very well said. On that note, it's been an honor having you join the show again. For those who want to hear more from you and get your more in-depth thoughts on the commodity space, tell us about The Independent Speculator, what it is you do there.
Well, sure. The Independent Speculator, sometimes people say that my service is expensive, but you know what? I let my clients buy before I do and sell before I sell. So part of the reason for the price tag there is that people get first dibs, and that costs me. I'm sharing my research. I'm saying what I'm going to do with my own money. And frankly, I need to be paid to do that. However, we do have, you know, before going whole enchilada, we do have a free service called the Speculator's Digest. And, you know, you can read it, see what you like of my thinking or dislike, agree or not. And the one promise I would make about that is if you sign up, we will not flood you with a horde of daily advertisements. I hate spam. You get one email per week, and you can see if you like how I think and whether or not you want to hire me to be your due diligence guy through my paid services.
And your free newsletter is a no-brainer. Everybody should sign up for that. Like you said, you don't spam anybody. It's one of the few newsletters that I read top to bottom every week when it hits my inbox. Very insightful. I will put a link to The Independent Speculator in the description below for people who want to check out that service and sign up for the free newsletter. Thank you once again, Lobo, for coming on the show.
Thank you, Jesse. Have a great day.
Commodity Culture is a podcast that covers investing in commodities and natural resources. If you'd like to hear more, be sure to subscribe so you are always alerted of the latest episodes.